Before Alaska became a state, a major worldwide scientific research push brought explorers to the Arctic, and the face of science would be different if this had not happened. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. This is the second edition of our AK at 100 series, where we seek your thoughts on the state's second 50 years of statehood. Our number, 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at alaskapublic.org. Here to talk with you today is Fran Ulmer, chairwoman of the Arctic Research Commission on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, providing insight on statewide business and government issues. There's more information online at akbizmag.com. And by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
And we really encourage your participation at 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage 550-8422, email talk at alaskapublic.org. Fran Ulmer, welcome back to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's nice to be here.
You have been on this program in probably more guises than anyone else, even Vic Fisher.
that I don't think is true. I think Vic tops me.
He's got
many,
more guises.
Many levels.
He may have more guises. You got a point there.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, here you are, having moved from politics, where I first knew you, to academia, and then to this new position at the Arctic Research Commission. So what is that like?
Well, first of all, it is not a full-time job.
I know that.
It is an important responsibility that I take very seriously because Alaska is America's Arctic. And so having an Alaskan as chair of the U.S. Arctic Research Commission, which is a longstanding tradition, I might note, is a very good thing. As you probably remember, Mead Treadwell was the chair, which is kind of funny because I was the lieutenant governor, so we've sort of switched jobs. We've talked a little bit about that. But over time, America really, you know, was asleep on the topic of the Arctic. And it's only within the last few years that America has figured out that the Arctic is a pretty special place filled with a lot of opportunities, a lot of resources, and more people are actually curious about and paying attention to the Arctic. So it's a wonderful time to be there and a great opportunity for the commission to do what its statutory mandate is, which is to shine a spotlight on the research that needs to be done and to share information about the research which has been done with key policymakers and the public. It's interesting, Frank Murkowski, introduced the legislation and got it passed in the early 1980s. But for quite a while, the commission was not something that people really thought about, listened to, paid much attention to. The U.S. government didn't pay very much attention to the Arctic, but all of that's changing.
Well, it has changed. And, I think when you have survey vessels going out there trying to figure out where the sea bottom is, because a whole lot of fossil fuel resources, among other things, territorial claims could be at stake. When you have a boundary dispute with Canada that's still not settled, there's money and politics suddenly involved in all this.
You know, Steve, if you look at the investment that other countries are making in the Arctic, not only from the standpoint of building icebreakers and ice-capable vessels, but also the investment they're making in research, it's pretty astounding. I mean, just listen to this one. Russia has 6 nuclear-powered icebreakers, and they have just committed to building 6 more. The United States has 1 functioning icebreaker, and it's over 30 years old, and it's only a medium class. It's not even a heavy class. And there's a dispute about whether we really need more icebreakers. It's amazing. Canada has just committed to $3.3 billion in building ice-capable vessels so that they can do what they need to do from the standpoint of protecting the Northwest Passage and responding to emergencies, vessel escorts, et cetera. Meanwhile, Congress is having a rough time even funding the Coast Guard, even funding the existing maintenance on the second icebreaker. So the good news is our congressional delegation's very, very key on making the kind of investments that we need, but a whole lot of other people in Congress haven't quite figured out that we are in something of a competition for who is going to be capable of not only accessing, making decisions about, doing research on, but also taking advantage of the future of Arctic resources.
Yeah. Well, Fran, it's great to have you in here. And I suddenly realized that talking about the next 10, 15 years of the next 50 years could be really fascinating, and we probably should. But I want to try and use your imagination and your background and mine and our listeners to try and think ahead 50 years, or really about 47, to when Alaska is 100 years old as a state and what things might be like here then. The State Labor Department has now come out with their forecast for the next 25 years, and it gets our population up to about 900,000. And that's as far as they go so far. And, you know, it certainly the oil industry, you can bet that they're looking 10, 15 years ahead at least right now. But for the most part, it's open ground. We can kind of make it up. And it's fun to do so, I think. And the way that I've been approaching it is going to the 50th anniversary of statehood, and then going back 50 years to the time before that, and what were things like back then? And, of course, we were just kids back then.
Indeed.
But nonetheless, you had, in 1957, you had Sputnik and the, this is before statehood, you had Sputnik, which totally changed the educational system. Suddenly, all the kids in my high school class were told by their guidance counselor, you have to become an engineer. I remember this. And then we had the International Geophysical Year, which for years I didn't even know what it was, but it turned out that it downloaded all these scientists up in Fairbanks particularly, but all over the Arctic, and they did this groundbreaking research that is the basis of our polar knowledge that we have now. Then you go ahead 50 years from that and you get to the International Polar Year, and you say, well, I wonder if that is as big a deal as the, you know, who knows? I don't really know. But there were so many things that Alaska, when it became 50 years old, if you go back and look 50 years back, you can see the seeds of all those things. So the question really is then, what are the seeds that we have present now that'll become really big things by that time? And there's so many of them to think of. In our last show, you know, I was trying to get around to like, oh, are we going to be an agriculture exporter? And when if the Arctic is ice-free, as all the scientific forecasts say, will there be tourists and where will they be and how will we handle them? And, you know, things like that. And my guests, who were, one was a consultant for mostly a Native and tribal organizations, and the other was in the Theater of the Imagination, a Screen Actors Guild actor who came up to Alaska for the theatrical opportunities, believe it or not, and now they're actually starting to happen. You know, they had a whole other set of things that they could picture 50 years from now as to, you know, we have right now a flurry of movie making, for instance. What's that? Is that going to amount to something? In 50 years, will the public's fascination be greater or less? I remember the things that came out during that show were, we have no manufacturing. Will we have manufacturing in 50 years? Still an open question. Are we really using our university? And this would be one you probably have some pretty good thoughts on. Are there things that our university could be investing in right now that might contribute to a positive vision over the next 50 years? That's just a couple. Our investments. What kind of investments could we be making now that might pay off very well 50 years from now? I can't even, you know, I've got grandchildren. I have no confidence at all that they're going to want to be in Alaska. None. That's mine.
Well, obviously, this is an important topic and a very relevant one as we celebrate all of these 50th-something or other anniversaries. And I might just note that the Institute of Social and Economic Research at UAA is celebrating its 50th anniversary this year. Matter of fact, next month there will be a series of events associated with ICER, former ICER directors, which I'm privileged to have been one of, along with Vic Fisher and many others, focusing on this question of what was different then, 50 years ago, than now, and where are we heading in the future? And of course, there are many different theories, many different opinions, many different opportunities. A couple of thoughts that come to mind, Steve. Alaska is positioned in so many ways better than other states from the standpoint of our natural resources. And I'm not only talking about oil and gas, I'm talking about renewable resources, renewable energy, which because of wind and tidal and a whole lot of opportunities that we aren't yet developing, but we can see on the horizon, a lot of states would love to be who we are. Let's talk about fisheries. I mean, we have a sustainable fisheries regime in Alaska that is often held up at international conferences as being an example that others should be following. So when I focus on the next 50 years, I see that fishery, I see those renewable energy resources, I see the non-renewable energy resources, I mean, the oil and gas and coal and others, as being things that enable us to continue development in a way, hopefully, that balances those things to keep our quality of life as high as it is today and gives us the opportunity to really be a state that others want to be part of, not just, you know, we had our 50 years of glory and now we, you know, extinguish the flame and we become just a memory. I don't see that. I think Alaska is so much better off than many other states. The point you raise, however, about what choices we should be making today to position those things well is something that I hope Alaskans spend more time with right now, because we do have the financial wherewithal to make some significant investments. I mean, that's the blessing of Prudhoe Bay. That's the blessing of that very amazing, largest ever in North American history oil field being on state land, not on private land. It has given a share of that wealth for Alaskans to make some choices and to make some investments. I agree with you that the university and K through 12 and a whole variety of other ways of empowering Alaskans to take advantage of those opportunities as opposed to simply sitting on the sidelines and watching others do it is still something that we have not realized at the level we should and could, given the fact that we have many human resources that are still undeveloped. When you're talking about dropout rates, when you're talking about people being unemployed, you see that we could make investments in people in a way that would not only empower them, but really fuel the opportunity for the state to take those natural resources to a whole nother level.
Well, remember, years ago, you and I sat in this studio or another studio, and you were on a bandwagon for civics education. And you know, you're always so upbeat, Fran. How do you think that one worked out? I think we might have lost a little ground in our civics knowledge over the years.
We lost some ground, but we also gained some ground. Remember, at that time, legislation was adopted that put in place a requirement to teach Alaska history.
I do, yeah.
So that, I think, was a step forward. There were awfully a lot of young people graduating from high school and from college and people wandering around who were clueless about Alaska's history and the complexity, the diversity. I think that requirement was a really good thing, and I think the school systems have put in place some programming that really helps people understand how different Alaska is from other places and how fortunate we are to have the Constitution that we have and the structure of our government from the way in which the governor and the legislative relationships are developed to the way our court system works. So I think that was a step forward. I agree with you that we still have a long way to go before we really reach a point where enough people are knowledgeable about how government works to be actively engaged in making it better and making it fit the needs of the day, as opposed to what is becoming a very popular and very cynical attitude of, gee, you know, I'm not going to pay any attention to it at all because it's just so messed up. In a democracy, when people stop paying attention and stop being engaged in government, whether it's at local, state, or federal level, then democracy's really in trouble because you leave it to only the people who have the most extreme views or the most specialized private interests.
Well, yeah, there are certain things that you just have to say are can't really go on the way they have been going on. You brought up being proud of our sustainable fisheries, for instance. But, you know, if you really look at how our fisheries are managed, it's kind of touch and go. It's Alaska's remoteness. It's where the people who do the fishing are the ones that divide the fish up. There are a bunch of political hurdles that we're going to get through one way or another in, say, the next 10, 15 years regarding marine reserves and conservation practice and all that basically the industry has not faced yet. Acidification and what that's going to do. And then that'll shake out. And that'll be long before 50 years from now, you know, 10, 15 probably. So you can say that. You can say, well, civics and ignorance and education reform, where's that all going to go? And you can kind of already see that education reform is finally going to get somewhere. That whether it's charter schools or vouchers or something, sooner or later the teachers unions are going to have to budge a little bit on teachers that just aren't doing the job. And there'll be some dead wood pushed out of the way, and we'll start getting a little bit more meaningful education going. Yeah, it has to happen. So some of these will just cycle out in 10, 12, 15 years, you know. But then again, you know, you look at 25 years, maybe they didn't.
You know, Steve, I was at a conference a couple weeks ago that was organized by the East-West Center at the University of Hawaii, and their focus is on sort of bridging the west coast of the United States to Asia. They invited me to speak, and I will note at their expense. And the whole focus was on the Asian nations' interest in the Arctic. So actually, most of the people attending the conference were from Korea, Japan, China. A few people from the U.S. and Canada, a number of people from Russia. And it was really interesting. One gentleman spoke about how the 20th century was the age of America and the 21st century will be the age of Asia. From his perspective, he went on to document, just from the standpoint of demographics, what was really different about the beginning of the 21st century from what has been going on in the 20th century. Let's remember that the United States is about 5% of the world's population. When we're sitting here in the United States, we tend to think of ourselves as much bigger than that. And in some ways, we are much bigger. Our economy is really big. Our use of oil and gas, we use something in the neighborhood of 20% of all the oil consumed every day, even though we're only 5% of the population. So I don't mean to say that this gentleman was necessarily right, but I think what his comment made me think about was how not only Alaska, but how the United States needs to think differently about this century than last century and needs to realize that we're not necessarily going to be in control of our destiny in the way in which we were in control of our destiny for the last 50 years, because we were sort of the biggest, most powerful, et cetera. So adjusting to an international age in which we are competing with other nations for intellectual capacity, for investment, for things as simple as, you know, who's going to be doing the research in the Arctic? Because who has the vessels, the ice-capable vessels, and the scientific expertise needed to do that work? I just think we have to change up our game. And Alaskans, I didn't mean to suggest by saying that we have a lot going for us from our, the standpoint of our resources, that we can take that for granted. I think if we are going to take advantage of what we are so fortunate to have, the scenery, the tourism, the wilderness, the clean water, the relatively clean air and fabulous, what I would describe as just an amazing quality of life, we can't sit still. We have to think proactively about how to blend those things in a way that assures a positive future and not just take for granted the past.
Thank you. Fran Ulmer is our guest, ready to talk about Alaska's next 50 years with you on Talk of Alaska at 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at APRN, and talk at alaskapublic.org. Have trouble getting used to that new one there. And we're open for business on all of those. Yeah, you're not getting 50 years ahead. You're still getting only 10 or 12. You know, we may have already hit, for instance, peak water. The world may have hit peak water. Just like they talk about peak oil, and there's this debate, did we hit peak oil or not? Where's the price going to go and all that? You know, peak water, all of a sudden, Wally Hickel becomes a visionary for one to have a garden hose, you know, floating on the Pacific Ocean and headed to California. Because already we're shipping water. We're already, you know, putting it in jugs and bladders and things and shipping it. And there will be more. You can just totally bet on that. Rare earths. Nobody quite knows. We don't want China to have a monopoly on rare earths, so something's going to happen, and that's going to require Alaska to be more rigorous in its approach to its mining industry. Right now, we don't really know how to. We don't have the regulatory beef to deal with mining at all in this state. But who's going to have to? We're going to have to learn. We're going to have to invest that money somehow, get that expertise someplace. And that was the kind of stuff that was coming up in the last show we did about this, is that somebody in the educational system needs to be forecasting, you know, 40, 50 years ahead and start thinking about how can we load this in at this end so that we're actually doing education and research, especially research, that is going to go where we need stuff. You know, we look at all the cyber field. That's probably a great one for Alaska. There are people, it's been brought up five or six times now, we have a resource of coolness in Alaska. We could cool server farms better than anybody. So there's probably some research needed there.
Actually, Norway and other places that have both coolness and an abundance of inexpensive energy are doing exactly that.
I was
in Iceland a couple months ago, and that is part of what they are doing with their inexpensive geothermal energy.
So you must run out of patience. You go to these things, you see China is exploring the Arctic. They're going to build the biggest, heaviest icebreaker in the world, China. Mm-hmm. They don't even have any territory in the Arctic. Korea, hugely interested, and here we are with the Healy, you know.
I know. It is an awareness thing. It is back to what I was talking about in terms of competitiveness. I think America needs to really get out of the sense of complacency. And for all of the movements that seem to be underway that want to take us back to 1950, we kind of need to get over the 20th century and move forward. Your point about changing education in a way that accommodates a future that right now we're not even sure what that future looks like. Let me just give one example of something that has been happening at UAA for the last couple of years. The new integrated sciences building at UAA completely changes how science is taught because it provides the opportunity for both the faculty doing the teaching and the research to integrate with other scientific disciplines to a much larger degree than sort of the old model of how you teach just chemistry, just physics. That approach of integrating the sciences is really designed to help students, as well as the research community, think differently when they are problem solving. And most of the best universities in the lower 48 are attempting to do what is being done right now at UAA and will be done at UAF as they build their new facility in Fairbanks to really push back the stovepipe approach of teaching and doing research in narrow cubicles and very narrow perspectives. That doesn't necessarily answer the question of what kind of science will be needed 25 years from now, but it educates students in a very different way so that they are going to be more flexible and more open and opportunistic in problem solving. And that's what we really need to do with education. It's not so much teaching people specific facts as it is empowering them to be clear thinkers and problem solvers.
Let's see if I can get the phone patch with Bob in McCarthy. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Fran Ulmer, Alaska at 100. Bob?
Yes, how are you? Had a couple comments. One, the issue of icebreakers and access to the Arctic. Keep in mind the Navy, the U.S. Navy has probably 100 ships in the way of submarines that do very well under the ice as well as up through the ice and have access to the North Pole. This has been the case, Nautilus back in the 50s, 1950s, came through the ice at the North Pole. And so access and patrol capability by the U.S. Navy is probably better than any other entity in the world. Secondly, the issue of the way Alaskans allow the private companies to get windfall profits off of their resources, the oil and so forth, just galls me. I think, like you say, the Alaskans need to provide for production and for fabrication capability in Alaska for the future. We need to make energy available from our resources to those companies that are willing to settle and produce in Alaska cheap. And in that regard, I think we need a company that is Alaskan run, not unlike the marine highway system, the ferry system, that can in fact provide cheap energy in the way of propane. The fact that Alaskans pay so much for propane, which they own originally, is ridiculous. They ought to be taking that out in kind from the wells that are producing the propane. The same with oil and gas that we need to consume. We ought to have a break on the oil and gas for Alaskan residents, and not allow these foreign companies, these international companies, Exxon and BP and all the rest of them, to make a killing off of our resources. Those are my comments, basically. That ought to be into the future, the idea of civics teaching the kids that they own the resources and they ought to benefit best from the resources is key. I think that was a wonderful comment, and that's basically all I have.
Bob and McCarthy, I want to thank you for your thoughtful response there, and Fran, he's got a point about the submarines, hasn't he?
Well, just a point about the Navy, you're absolutely right that the Navy has been paying attention to Arctic for a long, long time for a lot of strategic and defense reasons. The Navy recently came out with an Arctic policy statement about their views, their concerns, their desire for investment, their willingness to work with the Coast Guard and other agencies. But I'm sure if there was a Navy representative sitting right here next to me, he would tell you that they do not have all they need to be positioned for the future. And what they do have in terms of their assets are important for certain purposes, but are not useful for other purposes. For example, research platforms. I was in Wainwright last week, which is just to the west of Barrow and to the east of Point Hope, and is a village that is very likely to be a jumping-off point for ultimate OCS development in the Chukchi. It is currently a jumping-off point for the research community that is trying to document what is happening in the Chukchi, both from the standpoint of the walrus and from other biological research, but also understanding wind, water currents, weather, etc. There's a very interesting consortium of Shell, Statoil, ConocoPhillips, and now NOAA doing a partnership research effort in that way. I went out on the Westward Wind, which is the research platform that they are using. It's an old crab vessel that got retrofitted to be this research vessel. There is no doubt that its capacity to get very far offshore is quite limited. The guys who were just getting off of their tour of duty complained about every single day 17-foot waves. I mean, you know, there's a limit to what you can do on a submarine. There's a limit to what you can do on an old retrofitted crab vessel. There are needs from the standpoint of understanding currents, understanding the biological conditions, the ecological conditions of a region that is a U.S. asset, an Alaskan asset. And there is no doubt in my mind that a continuing partnership between the Navy, the Coast Guard, NOAA, the public and private sector will be essential, whether you're talking about the next 10 to 15 years or the next 30 to 50 years. We're going to have to change how we think about deploying assets in the Arctic so that they're not narrowly focused on just one use, but rather multiple uses. Because to respond, whether it's to a search and rescue need, a research need, an oil spill, God forbid, these are things that really require a wide variety of different kinds of ships, different kinds of ports and shoreside facilities. And our country simply is not making the kind of investment that we're going to need in the short or the long term.
Fran Ulmer, now chair of the Arctic Research Commission, is our guest as we look at AK at 100 one more time as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. The Rasmussen Foundation sabbatical program offers nonprofit executives and tribal leaders paid time away from their jobs for personal renewal and growth. As a result, organizations often become stronger. October 1st is the deadline to apply. Learn more at Rasmussen.org. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
Talk of Alaska. We're talking about Alaska at 100, the next 50 years of statehood and where we will be at the end of it. And Fran Ulmer is our guest today. And before we skip on to a few other areas, Fran, I want to get this. If Lawson Brigham was with us right now, I could ask him and say, well, where do you think the Deepwater Port's going to be? Because I think we're going to have a Deepwater Port. I mean, right now it's Dutch Harbor. That's not the Arctic.
Right, 1,000 miles away.
So he said, well, when we discussed, he said, well, once they get done fussing around, which apparently is a process that takes many years, they'll settle on Nome. Kotzebue is making a big push now.
I was just going to say, I think there are a number of communities, Kotzebue, Nome.
You're so diplomatic.
That are interested in finding a way that they can be part of what will be additional economic development. You know, when you attend conferences or read about the proposed route, either the Northwest Passage or the Northern Sea Route, either on top of Canada or on top of Russia, all of them go through the Bering Strait. So the Bering Strait is a choke point or an opportunity or a necessary place for us to think about ports of refuge or deep water ports or whatever, that particular piece of real estate has to get factored in to whatever northern route ultimately becomes part of the world commerce, whether it's just to get northern resources that are extracted from either Russia, Canada, U.S., or whatever down south, or if it actually becomes a transshipment route, who knows? But the need for onshore capacity, deep water port, ports of refuge, docks, et cetera, I don't think there will be just one. You know, when I look ahead to the next 25 to 50 years, there are different kinds of needs for different kinds of purposes, different kinds of ships, different kinds of responses. So I don't think it's one of those things where there'll just be one port developed. I think there will need to be a variety of facilities on the Alaska side of this shipping route, whether it's the Northern Sea Route or the Northwest Passage. And I might just note, you know, most experts in the field, and I don't consider myself an expert, Lawson Brigham certainly is. For those of you who are listening and don't know, he was the deputy director at the U.S. Arctic Research Commission and was responsible in large measure, along with a team of others, of course, for the Arctic Marine Shipping Assessment. That Arctic Marine Shipping Assessment, which was done for the Arctic Council, an international body that focuses on the Arctic, really identified the variety of concerns, challenges, opportunities, needs if Arctic marine shipping is going to happen. And there, if you Google that, if you're interested in the topic, they list out a variety of things that need to be done, from research to infrastructure investment. So it's a big topic. It's an important topic. It is unquestionably, I believe, going to happen at some level. So we really should become more focused on doing the analysis of the pros and cons for the variety of sites and the variety of kinds of facilities that will be needed.
Yeah, you know, there's an odd political paradigm at work. Alaska is the only Arctic state in the United States, and yet our political clout in Washington, D.C. is like way tiny compared to, say, California or many more populous states. We're never going to get that kind of population, and we're not going to have that kind of clout in the ultimate budget and policy machinery of Congress. So it really rests then with the executive branch to become more interested, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely, and I guess the good news is the executive branch is more interested than it used to be. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton went to the Arctic Council meeting in Nuuk, Greenland this spring, and she's the first Secretary of State to ever personally attend. Now, again, for our listeners, the Arctic Council is always attended by that level from the other nations of the Arctic. But the U.S. has been sort of, you know, a bit of a laggard in really paying attention to the Arctic. So the fact that Hillary Clinton actually went to that meeting personally sent a huge signal to the other Arctic nations that the U.S. is paying more attention. The fact that the State Department, Navy, Coast Guard, all of these agencies are developing Arctic policies and plans of action for the Arctic says a lot about the fact that people are waking up, that there are strategic reasons for the United States to pay attention to the Arctic and invest in the Arctic. But this is happening like in real time, like now. It hasn't been the case except in a couple of, a few examples that one could say, well, you know, 10 years ago there was this study, or yes, 50 years ago the Navy was involved. Absolutely. But there's a new level of awareness, and that's the good news. I do think it is an opportune time for the state of Alaska, the leadership of the state, and I mean our congressional delegation, our governor, our legislature, our business community, to come closer together in agreement on what our priorities are, that we can speak with a single voice to both the Congress and to the executive branch, the president and the agencies, about where the highest and best use of investment, both their investment and our investment. I think the time is ripe for that.
I believe I saw you in the audience for Julie Gourley from the State Department. Were you there, the Institute of the North thing?
I was out of town, unfortunately, but I do know Julie, and I know she was.
I'm sure you did. And she's the rubber meets the road person on the Arctic Council. And, of course, she was very happy that the Secretary of State chose to come to this. But she laid out a whole list of things that are going on. There's going to be a lot of activity coming up. And I was so happy to see her point to the Arctic Observatory. I don't know if you've heard about this one, but basically this is something that I know Jackie Grebmeyer has been pushing for the last 15 years. And she's basically, by hook or by crook, got people all meeting standardized measurements to get a transect through the Arctic. And this is totally out of the IGY heritage of the Geophysical Institute. I mean, she was a graduate student at UAF, and she just kept insisting because she knows this research needs to be done. And now the whole world is getting proud of this observatory that Jackie just thought up and kept pushing. So, you know, we do. I mean, when people have vision and can push and persist, I think we do get somewhere.
You're right. It does sometimes take longer than you'd like it to. But
thank goodness, a whole lifetime.
Thank goodness for people who don't give up and keep pushing. You know, you mentioned IPY a couple of times. Next spring, there will be a large meeting of many of the people who did research under this most recent IPY. They will come together in Montreal and do a reflective of what is the true value of the investment that was made by all of the nations that really decided research during the International Polar Year was important. What are the takeaways? And what does it tell not just the Arctic nations, but the world, about the need for data, for research, for understanding, for us to be able to make good choices about the Arctic's future? Because as you pointed out earlier, you know, climate change is happening, the ice is retreating, and change is everywhere, but it's the change in the Arctic is more pronounced than anywhere else on the Earth from the standpoint of the degrees warmer, the ice retreat, the changing ecology of the Arctic. So trying to assure that the nations who care about the Arctic, not just from the standpoint of what we can get out of it and take someplace else, but also for the people who live here, the indigenous people of the Arctic, this IPY moment really allows us to do what your friend was talking about a long time ago, which is assess what are the data gaps, how do we improve our understanding, and how can we link up the information so that it can be useful to public and private decision makers who are trying desperately to make good choices about how that development takes place.
Thanks a lot. Fran Ulmer is our guest. It's Talk of Alaska, and we got tons of callers here. Let's try and roll through a few of them if you're ready. Tom in Homer, welcome to Talk of Alaska with Fran Ulmer. Sorry it took so long to get to you.
Yeah, Fran, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to point out some of the dangers of the continued use of fossil fuels, and there are alternatives, but we need to protect our water, our soil, and our air. And there's a good reference by David Bloom called Alcohol Can Be a Gas, and it points out many alternatives and how to do it all. And it's been about 30 years in research, so it's a well-thought-out book. I just wanted to encourage you to get it and read it sometime.
All right. Thank you, Tom. Tom from Homer, thank you for hanging on for 22 minutes, too. That's pretty good. Helen joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Helen.
Oh, thank you for having me on. I would like to see some changes to the Silver Hand Program. I think the Tony Knowles administration, it was moved from the Department of Community, Commerce, and Economic Development to the State Arts Council, where it just pretty much died.
Yeah, they never get any money at the Arts Council.
Where the sister program to the Silver Hand Program, the Made in Alaska, is still in the Department of Community, Commerce, and Economic Development, and they have funding for enforcement, they have funding for a website, for training materials, for an online calendar, for sales events, and the Silver Hand Program has none of that support. And if that doesn't qualify for separate yet unequal, I don't know what would. And, you know, with this, enforcing the Silver Hand Program, most of the knockoffs on Alaska Native art is produced in Asia, where the one person that imports it is the one that benefits from those items, where the Silver Hand permittees live in Alaska, they support their community, pay taxes, buy from the local merchants, and keep their money circulating within the community, which is the best economic development the city and state needs.
Helen, that's absolutely fascinating, and thank you for your call. It's pretty clear some enforcement is needed there. I mean, these are our people and our products need to be taking it seriously here. Thanks again for that call. It's something I really hadn't thought about at all. The whole value-added question, it comes up every time, Fran, when we do this format of trying to look ahead 50 years. People say, well, we don't make anything. We need value-added. That's where we need to invest. How can you not see that? And you see an example right there. It says, look, we're not even enforcing on the locally made crafts. Maybe a good point. Let's go to Dave, joins the program from Cordova. Hi, Dave.
You caught me with my hands in the dishwater, but that's okay. They're clean. Good morning, and thanks for this great program. As you know, Steve, I've spent a lot of time up in the Arctic over the past 6 years and various research, and I thought I'd bring two things at least to the table, one of which is the Navy Admiral in charge of ports bases worldwide has undertaken as one of his main priorities to attempt to alleviate or ameliorate the rising seas that we're going to be encountering. He figures that is an enormous issue that the Navy is going to have to deal with in the next 10, 20 years.
Did you say fees or seas? Are you seas?
Not known to many is that about the nicest port up there, and it's already deep water and does not have the dredging issues that Wainwright, Nome, and a number of other places do, is Port Clarence, and it's connected by road to Nome via Teller. There's a group working on that, and I think that's going to ultimately prove to be the big bopper there. That's where the old Loran station used to be up there, Brevik Mission, whatnot in that region. But great program and very pertinent issues, and sure wish a certain lady there was the executive of the state right now. Somebody's looking ahead. Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, Dave, thanks a lot. Come on, you have to graciously accept that.
I appreciate it immensely. Thank you for the call.
All right, let's go to Bob, joins the program from North Pole. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Fran Ulmer, John. Bob?
Yes, good morning. Hey, terrific show. Some far-sighted people. It's a real privilege to be able to hear everybody's opinion. And good morning, Fran. My concern is maybe that clean coal power plant down in Healy could easily be turned into a smelter with a little bit of investment, and some of that made of Alaska could really have a meaning. And also the same with the flare pits up on the slope that could easily be turned into a smelter for some of this end of the road stuff that we have, the copper and other metals that are piling up here and there and waiting for the price to get high enough so they can ship it. But if we had it made in Alaska, our manufacturing would be invaluable for the state for a number of generations, and these kids can easily learn into this kind of manufacturing, and it would be beneficial to a lot of people. It certainly would put Alaska ahead a little bit. Australia seems to have a right idea on their smelting, and it'd be well worth it.
Hey, Bob, how clean is a smelter? Do they make clean smelters? Is that possible?
I think with the slope, with the flare pits they have up there, if you put it through electrical generation for a smelter, that would be very clean. I don't think they would have any of the byproducts that would affect, and it also cool the flare pits down enough so that the carbon monoxide and all can be pumped back into the earth, and it wouldn't have a problem. But as far as the clean coal, that's kind of a future for the youngsters to be able to curtail that, you know, the mercury and the other vapors that come out of there. The scrubbers seem to be working okay, but there's still a couple of bugs in there that I'm sure, you know, the education of the young ones can easily tackle that problem. It was in the next, you know, 50 years.
Yeah. Often this is a cost thing. I mean, that's what I you know, like, I watched this whole latest iteration of the idea that we can somehow sequester the coal from our sequester the carbon from our burning of coal to generate power, and what killed it, and it did die again for the third time that I've watched during my time of watching this stuff. It did die, and it was once again money, because the industry has no incentive to make that type of investment and no assurance that if they scale up the technology, they really have a they really put their money in the right place, and that's what I've seen.
You know, Steve, the question of economics is always, for as long as I've been in Alaska, and I moved here many, many years ago, 1973, a lot of good ideas that would be wonderful from the standpoint of value added, from the standpoint of creating a more diversified economic base, from the standpoint of providing good jobs for Alaskans. It comes down to economics. And part of the frustration, I think, that many of us who have lived here for a long time is trying to understand how we can take our location and our small population and turn those into assets that do not compete with the very challenging economics of our location and our small population. The very things that are good on the one hand create some really tough burdens on the other hand, particularly when it comes to heavy investments that are required, and that invariably is part of changing the use of big facilities or making manufacturing work. The good news is we live in a state where Alaska Native corporations that are a big economic driver in our state have the opportunity to make investments because they have the financial wherewithal, or some of them do anyway, and they have the vested interest in making the economy of Alaska work for Alaskans. That's a really different situation than we were in 25 years ago. 25 years ago, there was much more of the, if the outsiders don't see it as a good thing, they forget it right away. The Alaska Native corporations are positioned to want to make the economics work in a way that I think gives us hope that some of these things that may have been considered economically marginal in the past maybe will be given a second look because we have people who care about the economy in Alaska in a different way.
Thank you, Fran Elmer. Thank you, Bob from North Pole. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. A PFD reminder, check the status of your 2011 PFD application with My PFD Info online at pfd.alaska.gov. You can view or change your voluntary deductions until Wednesday, August 31st. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska.
It's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about Alaska. We're talking about Alaska's next 47 years. It's a second 50 years of statehood, and where will we be in 50 years? We can't get there. I can't get there. Fran Elmer, she is so tied in with things, you know, trying to get things that need to happen now or in the next few years to happen. That she just can't get there.
Well, you know, my crystal ball doesn't go out to 50 years. I wish it did.
Yeah, but a good way is to go back. And that's what I'd like to do now is to go back. And tell us a little bit, because you were, I mean, you were part of the creation of the Permanent Fund.
I was fortunate enough to work for Jay Hammond, first as his legislative assistant and then as director of policy development and planning. So I spent 6 years working for Jay. A remarkable man who was able to see into the future better than a whole lot of people were. He had a long-term vision for things as opposed to just a short-term, let's get it done attitude. I have and always will have the highest degree of respect for not only Jay's vision, his capacity to see things in the long term, but his sense of fairness and his desire that everybody gets some benefit from the resource. I mean, really, his concept of the permanent fund dividend, some people love it, some people hate it. The reality is it was a way of giving everybody a piece of the action, something that was a benefit that they could choose to use in whatever way they chose to use it, but it was a piece of that resource wealth. And I happened to be looking through some old files, and I found the press release that was issued when Jay Hammond left office after 8 years in office. And his quote is, "My greatest satisfaction is in helping the people create the permanent fund, for it can help provide a better balance between rational resource development and adequate environmental protection." And then he closed with the thing that he usually used as his litmus test for whether or not a particular project should go forward or not. And you probably remember this. "We should distinguish between healthy and malignant growth by evaluating proposals on the basis of three prime criteria. Is it environmentally sound? Can it pay its own way? And do the people want it?" He used that sort of that threesome many, many, many times in meetings, in speeches. Those three sort of simple things. Is it environmentally sound? Can it pay its own way? And do the people want it? And of course, there's a lot of complexity under each and every one of those. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to oversimplify it. But it's a good way of thinking about, as we move into the next 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, it's not a bad way for us to think about the trade-offs that we see. And yes, working for Jay was quite remarkable because he wanted to listen to people. We held Alaska Public Forum meetings all over the state before the vote on the permanent fund in 1976 to basically listen to people what their hopes were for the future. When that was happening, the pipeline was being built. As you may remember, oil started flowing for the first time in 1977 down through the pipeline. So the vote on the permanent fund was before oil was there flowing to Valdez. And what people said, we know oil isn't going to last forever. As a matter of fact, we thought that the oil would be over by now. I mean, it was supposed to be a 25-year life. It just goes to show you it's pretty hard to predict the future. But asking people what they care about, what they think about, whether or not it's environmentally sound and whether or not it can pay its own way seems to me a good guide for the next 50 years.
Thanks a lot, Fran Ulmer. Thanks for being with us. I look forward to the next time.
Thank you, Steve.
Who knows what it'll be next time? Thanks to Dave Waldron, Pat Yak, and BD Trantina. I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. We all need energy to power our homes and businesses. Tapping renewable energy sources like wind, geothermal, and hydro helps keep our economy local, creating jobs, revenue, and power for the state. Learn more at realaska.org. This message sponsored by Renewable Energy Alaska Project, committed to creating a sustainable economic future for Alaska. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.